What's up, friends? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And, of course, as always, King of the Dials, sitting across the table from me, fiddling around and coughing and hacking, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm glad to be here in studio and beautiful weather for Texas. It's a beautiful day. Beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Hey, I've got to see that movie. Have you seen it advertised?
I've seen it advertised, the documentary for Mr. Rogers. And, you know, there's a lot of rumors out there concerning him that he was once a Navy SEAL.
Yeah, but I don't think that was real,
No, it's not real. But I'm just saying there
are
crazy...
It'd be awesome if it was.
Oh, wouldn't it? It's one of those things, conspiracy theories, that you would hope is real. Like, oh, it would be really cool if it turned out that he was really an assassin or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
He was just a nice guy. He just liked to change sweaters a lot.
Yeah. No joke, when I was a kid, that was one of the things that I remember. Like, I remember taking like my shoes off and putting them in a shoe box and all. I thought that was how you had to act as an adult, because like we've talked before, we didn't have, and definitely I growing up, and I know you growing up, we didn't have more than, we've told you all this before, more than like 3 or 4 channels. We lived, both of us, out in the country. There was no such thing as cable, and we couldn't afford satellite or nothing like that. So you had whatever the antenna would pick up. And I remember watching Mr. Rogers a lot. And I thought that was the way adults acted. Like, you had to put on a sweater when you got in the house, and, you know, you took off one set of shoes and put on your other shoes and all this. Yeah, I used to love the show.
I used to watch that and Sesame Street, of course, as a kid, and then Reading Rainbow would come on.
With LeVar Burton?
Yeah, and then...
Geordie LaForge?
3-2-1 Contact. And then on, like, Saturdays, Peppermint Place would come on with Muffin and Mr. Peppermint.
Mr. Peppermint.
But I know that's only a regional thing. I think that was only here in Dallas.
Yeah, because his son is the lead singer of the Butthole Surfers.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's Mr. Peppermint.
Mr. Peppermint.
Yeah, that was a great show, too. And then, of course, like we always talked about, we had to watch Kung Fu Theater. Are you crazy?
Crazy?
Yeah, what, are you out of your mind?
I mean, I still am entertained by that today, as any listener of this show knows.
So I'm going to bring up something that Kyle ranted to me on the phone about just a couple of days ago.
Which time? I mean, I pretty much have a rant every day.
Every day when I talk to you. But you was really worked up about this. Shark Week got you going.
Yeah, once again, it's Cam's favorite week of the year because it's constantly showing sharks. And, you know, I like to watch it. And Luke, he loves it. He's blowing me up with the Meg. The Meg's coming out on August 10th. In his mind, we're all going to see it on the 10th of August. And I've actually been listening to the audiobook, The Meg. And it's
You're welcome.
Good. Yeah, it's pretty good. Cam turned me on to it. He said he read the books. I've never read them. And
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm sure the movie won't follow the book.
No, I can already tell it doesn't.
Yeah, you know. But yeah, it's very good. If you're interested in that, I suggest checking out The Meg. But back to Shark Week. My only problem with Shark Week is they just constantly keep replaying the same shows I've seen. I think they have like 3 new shows every year, right? So the whole week, 24/7, nonstop, re-airing of shows they've done before. I've seen Air Jaws maybe 36 times now. I mean, I got it.
Maybe it ought to just be called Shark Hour.
Yeah, well, they have the Shark After Dark, and I did see a new one the other day with Ronda Rousey on there, and her man, what's his name, Brown?
Travis Brown.
Yeah, they were in there, and then I saw...
Isn't he a Hawaiian?
Yeah, I believe he is.
He's a great big son of a gun.
Yeah, most people don't think of that. They look at him, you know, and they don't think that he's Hawaiian. A lot like people don't think that Stipe Miocic is from, like, Ohio.
Yeah.
Right? They always think he's from, like, Belarus or something. Yeah. Like, no, dude, he's Croatian, but he's American.
Yes.
He's of Croatian descent, but... I did see that. So that was a new episode, and I was just watching one yesterday where they were showing these great whites washing up on the shores of South Africa, and they're all missing their liver. So, and they're trying to figure out what in the heck would be capable of destroying a great white shark and only removing the liver. So naturally, here I go. I'm instantly assuming it's like Japanese fishermen, right? Like these guys are, they need the liver for some of their potions and compounding needs, you know, because they always take like crazy things for their herbs. So I'm thinking, oh, it's got to be Japanese, not whalers, but shark fishermen. They're stealing the livers. Turns out it's orcas.
What?
Yeah, they've actually captured film of orcas for whatever reason. They like to grab great white sharks, flip them upside down and eat their belly out and then just eat the liver and that's it.
God, I love an orca.
So... Who would have thought? I mean, this is apparently was just discovered last year that they were even doing this. I mean, they knew that orcas could beat a great white shark in a head-to-head battle because they're much larger. I mean, if anyone who's been to
Well, and orcas hunt in packs, like wolves, too.
They do. They hunt in packs. They're highly intelligent, more intelligent than sharks. I don't think sharks are very smart. I think they're basically just eating machines, right? They just bite everything.
That's what it seems like.
That's why they got replaceable teeth. That's why they find tiger sharks with license plates and tires in their belly. Yeah. I mean, they pretty much just eat anything, right?
They're like an ocean billy goat.
A human, I mean, it's just a complete accident most of the time. They're just like, what is that? Oh, no, I don't want to eat that. Unfortunately, you've got multiple puncture wounds all through your thorax. And you bleed out, so that's not good. But yeah, orcas are much more intelligent, and apparently they don't really care for great white sharks except for their liver, which I'm not hating because, hey, I like liver. Now, my wife refuses to cook it. She refuses to have me cook it in the house because she says it stinks up the kitchen.
So you have to get it when you go out somewhere that serves it?
Well, that or like a deer camp or something like that.
When we go camping.
I like liver, so I can imagine, I can totally see why orcas like it too.
I don't, you know, that's a good point, is I don't know the studies done on great, because I know they're extremely solitary animals.
Yeah.
I'm with you, is I don't know what the intelligence, as far as compared to an orca, there's probably no comparison.
Yeah, no. Orcas are on another level of intelligence. That's what makes it so sad to keep them in captivity.
Yes.
And I think that's going away, right? Ever since the documentary Blackfish came out.
I hope so.
Marine Land up in Canada, I think, is pretty much closing its doors if it's not already.
Well, it's like we talked about. I understand whenever they put like gazelles and antelope in
the giraffe,
zoo.
Right?
Yeah, I get that because, I mean, they're just like keeping cattle pinned up. Like, I understand it. You feed them. They just live out
there. They got a better life. They don't have to worry about predators killing them.
Nothing's going
to
eat them. But if you put like a jaguar or a tiger or a lion or an orca in a cage, it's a different thing at that
point.
Sad,
man. Yeah. That they're intelligent and they're meant to chase things. And when you take that away from them, they're pretty much useless.
So over the weekend, my son went to Missouri and the Show Me State.
Yeah. Missouri?
Yeah, went to Missouri.
Okay.
And I always think of it as Missouri because I told you of Outlaw Josie Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember when he called it the Missouri boat ride? Don't they shoot? He shoots that rope.
Yeah,
with like that old Sharps rifle, isn't it? And then they go floating down.
Yeah, they go floating down.
Yeah, the whole, isn't it the red legs that are after him and he shoots the rope? And
yeah,
they're
coming across that ferry.
Yeah. That's when the guy's selling that elixir to get stains out.
Yeah, and he spits that big chunk of
on his white jacket. He goes, "How is it with stains?"
It's a classic movie.
So he's up there. Yeah. So I was asking him how that went.
Did he hang out with Nelly?
You know, I don't know. Probably. Knowing him, probably. Yeah. So he went to some lake. I couldn't even tell you what it was. I haven't even got the name then, but he was talking about how pretty it was, this, that, and the other. And then the synchronicity of the world hits, and I find this from Cryptozoology News.
Ooh.
Two Missouri men report seeing Bigfoot creature.
Okay. Tell me more.
Yeah. These fellas claim they saw an unidentified bipedal creature. Now, says they were hunting in the woods when they come across this. This is back November 24th. Yeah, that's right. November 24th, 2017. Now, this is what they reported to the BFRO up there. It says, while walking, this fellow goes, I could hear something walking down in the woods below me, appearing to keep up with my pace. I was close to the hunting blind, and then, and of course, I picked up my friend, and we went to the side of the field and quickly got back to our vehicle. Says it was on their way back when they could see what this thing was making sounds.
Uh-huh.
A clear make out of this. It says at first the headlights were not on it, and I was trying to figure things out in my head of what possibly could be this big of a creature on our property, and it was about 60 yards below our barn. It says when my headlights hit it, this creature stood there for less than a minute. It looked at us and then, not really any hurry, just strolled away, turned around, and walked back into the cedar thicket. And it says that the men got out of the truck to get a better look at what they described as huge creature.
Right.
That was around 8 feet tall. So that at first we thought it was a horse. And then we noticed it had arms attached at the shoulders. Said it had shaggy hair of a reddish chestnut color. And its eyes were orange. And here it is again, under the effect of the truck's headlight. So it's got that orange glow.
Right, yeah.
And it says that they claim to have seen the creature an additional two times after that. And when they tried telling people about all this, said nobody believed them. Said that all the people that they told thought they were crazy. So again, we go back into this. How many people do you believe have had something like this unexplained? Let's not say they were seeing Bigfoot, because like we've covered numerous times over the years, we're not even sure it exists. We've had all these people on, and I want it to be real, but there's no definitive proof of it being there. But how many people have had these encounters and not told anyone about it because of the stigma that comes along with it.
I think it's very popular, especially with the older generation. I think younger generations like us and millennials and stuff that listen to the show, they're much more likely to share their experience, right? Everybody's sharing everything on social media. But if you go back to your like grandfather's generation, they wouldn't tell you anything. I mean, if it was Sasquatch probably there all the time, he wouldn't say anything. You know what I mean? They just were tight-lipped.
Yeah. Do you think it's a one-for-one like report to somebody that doesn't report it?
I think it's bigger.
You think that that's... Oh, so you think like for every report that gets out, there's 10 that doesn't get reported?
I think so. I think that a lot of people probably have seen one and dismissed it in their mind because they refused to believe it, and they tell themselves that it was a brown bear or a black bear. You know what I mean? How many times have you met people that they know the truth, but yet they just won't let themselves... They'll even tell you. Like, I know it...
We've got friends like that.
But I'm not... I refuse to believe it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it happens quite often. But speaking of something that they thought was a horse, check this out. This is a pretty interesting article by Xavier Ortega over on Ghost Theory. You should check out that blog. It's pretty cool. It talks about in July of 1878, the New York Times wrote an article called What a Farmer in West Virginia Saw. Now, this article talked about a telegram that had come from a small town in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and addressed to the Cincinnati Commercial Tribune in regards to a terrifying event witnessed by a couple of farmers early one evening. Check this out. It says it was around 7 o'clock on a cloudless evening that a farmer happened to glance up towards the sky. Now, taking a break from his plow, the farmer noticed something dark in the sky off in the distance, an opaque object that seemed to be floating towards him and a group of other farmers. The other men were too busy tending to their crops to have noticed it at first. Standing in a mute confusion, the farmer tried to make sense of what he was looking at off in the distance. As the object got closer, it became clear that what the farmer was looking at was a horse swimming in the clear atmosphere.
Wait.
Yep, you heard me. High above the men in the fields. Stunned, the farmer rubbed his eyes in disbelief. The horse appeared to be thrashing its head and neck from side to side while kicking violently as it continued to ascend at about a 45-degree angle. There was nothing on or around the animal that could explain how it ended up in the frightening situation. All the farmer could do is stare helplessly as the animal kept ascending higher and higher. It was at that point that he called out to the other men in the field and asked them to look up.
Hey guys, look up!
The men glanced towards the sky and caught the awful sight of the animal floating towards the growing darkness in the sky. Now the men, frightened to the core, were later able to describe it as a white horse swimming in the sky. So what happened in those fields above that fateful summer sky? They don't know. Was it someone playing a joke on the farmers? Was it a hallucination? Or, as Xavier believes, is maybe they witnessed a animal abduction, right? The animal's being abducted by an unseen craft and I guess was held in its tractor beam or whatever and was being pulled up. I mean, we talk about cattle mutilations. We talk about people being abducted. They talk about being floated out of their bed through their window up into a craft. Did they happen to see a horse being abducted in broad daylight? Because what else would explain a horse that appeared to be floating in the sky, rising ever so slowly, thrashing around, kicking violently as if it was being taken against its will? I mean, and you're talking about in 1878, so there was like no police system or special effects crane. You know, what were they looking at?
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, they clearly describe it as a horse, not something that looked like a horse. I mean, they say it was a horse. So what a bizarre sighting. And if it was an abduction, it fits in perfectly with our guests that we're having on today. That's right, folks. We're having them on again for the third time. Joshua Cutchin, he's a personal friend of ours. He's a full-time author and musician. He's written three incredible books that every person who's into the paranormal should definitely have in their library. The first time we had him on, he talked about his book, A Trojan Feast, the food and drink offerings of aliens, fairies, and Sasquatch. And then again, he came out with the next book, which was amazing, The Brimstone Deceit, an in-depth examination of supernatural scents, otherworldly odors, and monstrous miasmas. And today, he'll be joining us for a third time to talk about his latest book, Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions. And like I mentioned before, this book is fantastic. I suggest you pick it up. We had a very interesting conversation. Joshua always approaches things from a different and new angle. That's what I like about his writing. And he's just a great guest to have on. So let's take a break. When we get back from the break, we're going to be talking with Joshua Cutchin. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right, folks, we got a very special treat for you once again. It feels like it's been forever since we talked to this guy. We've had him on the show two other times. He's an excellent author. The first time was for a book called The Trojan Feast, and the second time was, what was the name of that one, Cam? The Brimstone Deceit.
Yeah.
An amazing author. He always comes at things with a new angle, and that's what I appreciate about his work the most, Mr. Joshua Cutchin. Joshua, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great now. I'm talking to two of the best guys in paranormal podcasting.
Uh-oh, look out. Oh, now that's a big claim.
Yeah.
I know. I stake my claim now, so I gotta back it up.
We don't support that. So he's been drinking, folks. He's been drinking.
I was just driving through. I briefly talked about this before the recording. I was just driving through just past Dealey Plaza this morning, and I instantly thought of you, and I was like, man, I'm going to be talking to Joshua later tonight. And it was almost 2 years ago where I had you, and it was me and Micah Hanks, and we met Red Pill Junkie and Greg Bishop and Tim Banal there at Dealey Plaza. For most of us, it was their first time, and I can't believe that was already 2 years ago.
I know. Time keeps on.
I know. We need to figure out some other way of getting together and meeting up again. That was a lot of fun. But you're here today. Forget about the past. Let's talk about this new book. This new one. Man, it strikes close to our hearts because it has a lot to do with the fae folk, and we love the stories of the fae folk and fairies, also extraterrestrials, and the link between the similarities between the two of the stories. This new book, Thieves in the Night. Can you tell our listeners out there a little bit about the book? What got you going down this path? Because you know, your first book was about the links between the paranormal and like food and things you eat. And then your second was a lot having to do with the paranormal and the senses of smell and the smells associated with paranormal sightings. This is completely different than that. And I will say it's very dark. Cam, you were just telling me that you don't know if you're going to be able to sleep.
He took a dark twist on me. That's what I told him off air. I'm like, I wasn't ready for this. I'm all jovial going into it. And then you get in and you're like, wait a minute. I was not prepared for this. And what I was going to say, too, was I think the chapter titles really make a book, and Josh was the best in the biz at the titles of his chapters. I love the names that where you come up with all this stuff, just like the name of the book. Where you come up and drag all this out is the best thing ever. So I can't the work that went into this one. Just if you scroll to the back and look at everything where he had to go through. So how long did it take you to put this whole book together?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I feel like the idea for the next one kind of comes from the last one. You'll run across little tidbits here and there that sort of inspire you to do the next one. And it was sort of obvious, you know, leap from food to smells. But this one was just something that is a sort of recurring theme. So I got the idea during during the Brimstone Deceit. I said, if people have good things to say about something similar that you've done twice, do something completely different and see if it's still good. You know? I started research on this in January of 2017. Wrapped it up in about November of 2017 because I really try to put my nose to the grindstone and crank these things out. Plus, like, I'm one of those guys that if I'm not working on it, it's always running in the background of my brain. So all my relationships suffer if I don't have this thing down on paper. So, got it down on paper and then been going back and forth with my publisher, Patrick Weege of Anomalous Books. Always does a great job helping with publishing and editing and promotion and sort of lining up all that. And then the excellent artwork by Sam Sheeran took some time to come through, and Sam has made a cover that I can't speak to the efficacy or the lasting quality of my book, but I think Sam has done a cover that is just as impactful as that original communion cover. So all these sort of moving parts took some time to come together, and here we are about a year and a half later. So that's how long these things take in my lifetime to manifest.
Well, it worked out perfect. Like we were talking about, this is we get so many books and we read so many books and we talk to so many different people. This book, though, is like Kyle said, it hits us because of all the Fae connections. And I guess even when you had gone back from your original book of the Trojan Feast and you had talked about it, it felt we even discussed it with the connections of don't take food or drink from the Fae people. And it's like little strings. I see what you're talking about as it wove it together. But when you came out with this one, this was the perfect culmination. Anybody that's into to the Fae and fairy folklore, and then even so with the alien abduction folklore, this book is perfect for that because you bring it all together to where it's an argument that you're, for me, it was one of those things that there's an argument there to where it's like, it feels like it's one and the same. And I know a lot of people are going to scream at their device or their headphones or wherever they're listening to this because they don't want it. They don't want to think, they like to think that it's separate. Like alien abduction is completely separate from everything, stands on its own. But when you look at all these and then you start linking this in with the missing people and the things that you've wove into these stories, it all feels like it's one entity, or it's one big bubble that this stuff's, it's one company rather that they're all working for. Is there something, I guess the question would be, is there, was there one thing that really tied it in for you when you started down this path that all of a sudden, like a light bulb moment? Did you have one of those where you're like, wait a minute, I didn't realize that until right now?
Well, you know, for me, you know, looking at the work that really Jacques Vallée was one of the big pioneers of, in terms of drawing a lot of these connections between older mythologies, especially, you know, fairy mythology in Celtic countries and the UFO phenomena. I was sort of fascinated by some of the parallels that he pointed out, and those, you know, I saw more and more of those parallels. And I don't want to say I'm a pro pan paranormalist, but I think there's at least something shared between a lot of these things, with plenty of wiggle room in that to say, well, yes, there probably is something that is flesh and blood wandering around the woods that is Bigfoot. There probably is some sort of evidence of actual extraterrestrial visitation at some point. But I think the bulk of these contact experiences in a lot of these different areas share more in common than they really differ. With me, sort of partially another thing that was sort of a genesis for this, as I was looking for that sort of light bulb moment, because I've come to believe that anything you will find in alien lore will be mirrored in fairy lore in some capacity, and vice versa. But there were two primary areas where I wasn't really convinced of that central thesis, that central sort of guiding opinion in terms of that comparison. And those were, number one, alien implants, which I have since found something that I think sounds very much like an analog for this idea of the fairy blast, that the fairy folk might actually, with a gust of wind, put a bit of dirt or debris under your skin and give you a welt or a boil. I think that's a pretty clear comparison there. But the thing that really drove this book was the alien hybrid program. People have pointed out comparisons between descriptions of changelings in fairy lore and alien hybrids, but the comparison has pretty much ended there, and those comparisons have been quite robust. But I wanted to see if there were some other ways that the alien hybrid program reflected some of this earlier fairy lore in other different ways. And so basically for me, this entire book was really a learning experience of trying to put that particular inconsistency to a test. And I think that with a little bit of, if you squint just right, I think that it's pretty easy to see that there's something similar here. I don't think that fairy folk accurately describe what's going on with these contact experiences. I don't think that extraterrestrials accurately describe what's going on with these contact experiences. I do think that they are primarily discussing the same thing, but I don't think either real interpretation is getting to how intensely weird this thing really is. Whatever it may be. Yeah.
I was going to ask, I like how you start out the book where you're talking about, you know, the biggest question is when it comes to abduction, that why are children, I guess, more susceptible to being abducted than adults? And you even point out that perhaps children are subject to paranormal encounters because, I like how you phrase this, he says their souls are freshly minted and their souls are weaker and they're not fully attached to their physical form. And it does seem like that. It almost seems like children perhaps can tune into something that adults can't see, and you bring that up, and I like that. Why do you think that children seem to be more susceptible to these abductions than adults?
Well, it's sort of a bit of a trope in horror lore or in, you know, in sci-fi films that children have more malleable minds. But I do suspect that there really is something to that. I mean, in certain cultures, it was believed that children's souls hadn't fully entered their bodies. You know, in other cultures, it was felt that if you didn't name the child, it really wasn't a fully formed human being. So there are these sort of cross-cultural beliefs that you'll find. You know, if you look at a lot of reincarnation research, past life memories tend to peak around age 7, which is a real prime time for both alien abduction and fairy abduction in particular. As our definitions of adulthood have shifted later, it seems like alien abductions tend to start a little bit later than fairy abductions would, which would begin in infancy. But you know, I think that old trope, there's a kernel of truth in it about these minds being younger and more malleable. I mean, the first 3 human years of life are critical for neurodevelopment. During the first 3 years, you actually have the most development in your brain, and then the development actually tends to slow down after that. So with all this particular development happening, it seems like there might be a little bit more of an opportunity to influence young children in terms of neuroplasticity and in terms of sort of the way that they interact with and perceive the world.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, like you were talking about, past life remembering of people with past lives, it seems to be very strong when they're young, and then it kind of fades as they get older. Also, a lot of kids have imaginary friends.
Imaginary friends tend to peak around that sort of 7-year age too. And you know, as part of me wonders, and I'm sure that a lot of us are actually just conflating things and making things up, but I suspect that everyone that you find will at least say that they remember something truly anomalous, like truly profoundly anomalous happening to them in childhood. And as they've grown older, they've sort of explained it away, similar to what you guys talk about on the show, how like we actually experience more paranormal things than we realize because we're quick to write them off. Mm-hmm. But I feel that even you can find someone who's like, nope, nothing's ever happened to me. I go to work and I come back and I sit down and I have a beer and I go to sleep and I get up and go to work. Somebody who's had that sort of cookie cutter life, I suspect that if you really dug down deep, you would find that even those people who have been sort of living out the drudgery of life from day to day and haven't had anything genuinely anomalous happen to them, there's something that at the time they perceived as being really, really strange.
Yeah, you're 100% right. The part that got me is what, and keying off of what you two were talking about, was not just the 7-year age, that window there, but you also touched base on, it depended on, at points, even, and this is from even in the past, of the day or the month that these children were born on or in could even play more to it. Like November being a very busy month for not just abduction, but almost like for the kids born in that month time, or even like kids born, what was it, like on a Wednesday or something, increased their chances?
Yeah, I mean, so Fridays were typically bad luck. What's the word I'm looking for? Liturgical holidays like Whitsuntide were bad luck. Sundays were generally considered to be good luck. Abductions were more likely to happen on Wednesdays, which is sort of an oft-mentioned observation that John Keel supposedly made. I've had some difficulty tracking down the exact citation, but was that UFO phenomena tends to peak on Wednesdays. But yeah, generally speaking, you were more likely to be abducted on late November days, Wednesdays, May Day, St. John's Eve, Fridays, and of course that sort of period around Samhain, you know, Halloween. Those were all times that you didn't want to be out and about, especially on misty days, you know, these sort of misty, rainy days, which are days that that fairies would travel about in storms.
Well, and when you brought up, and I got to looking into that, I got to thinking about, of course, the ties, and I'm sure that all the stuff that you've come through that David Plotis has written, there's a lot of people go missing, adults especially, in the month of November in the mountainous areas. And I always attribute it to that's when hunting season is usually in the United States. In the mountainous areas between September and January is when it's going to be a very busy time for people to be in the outdoors. It's cooler weather. It's things like that. But then when you look at the history, the things that you had found, it kind of shines a new light on it that you're like, well, wait a second. So it's caused me to start looking back at older cases that I've covered and that read to start lining up months and days. I haven't even thought about looking up the days of when these people were born on, but it's extremely interesting of the things that you've dug up just on that. Not to mention the fact that I love the, I'm hoping that you coined this term Phalians. I'm yeah. really hoping that you could, because that's, dude, I'm a big fan of Phalians now. This is my thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe I did. I don't know if somebody else can find another spot, or a source for it. Earlier than me, I'll be glad to say that I didn't, but I really like it because I think that it sort of strips away those labels and says, you know, here are these things that arrived in some sort of bright light and they were short and they waved a wand at somebody and paralyzed them and took them into some sort of odd subterranean environment and did things to them and brought them back. Like, to me, that it emphasizes how interchangeable a lot of these stories really are. You know, the missing 411 thing, I'm fond of saying that it's a paranormal Rorschach test and that whatever you're really into, you'll see in missing 411. And of course, then I always have to follow that up and say, well, the ironic thing is that I'm really into fairy lore. So of course I see, yes. of course I see fairy lore because I just called myself out on that sort of paranormal Rorschach test. But, you know, people who are big into the ETH, into ufology will think that it's, you know, UFOs abducting people. People often say Sasquatch, but I personally feel like a lot of these tend to break down if you look at some of the outlying consistencies. Like, I mean, I don't think that Bigfoot can control the weather, and inclement weather is a huge thing with missing 411, at least Bigfoot in the sense that a lot of cryptozoologists would, you know, really mm-hmm. endorse. Some of the alien ideas, I think, tend to lack a little bit of nuance with when you get into things like areas of the landscape, like boulder fields. I mean, people have tied, you know, minerals to UFOs and whatnot, but that doesn't really resonate with me. But the only thing that I've found really personally that tends to check off a majority of the data points is fairy lore. I mean, you know, you've got the inclement weather, which I mentioned, you know, fairies travel on storms. They tend to inhabit boulder fields commonly. Berry picking is a huge factor in missing 411, and it's one of the most dangerous places. One of the places you'll most likely run into fairies. There's actually a great book called "The Good People," edited by. Hold on, let me check and make sure that's the title.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was thinking that about the berries.
Yeah, it's over here on my shelf as well. I was checking it. It's called "The Good People," and it's edited by a scholar named Nervais, and his actual. Contribution to this article, or to this volume rather, is an analysis of looking at berry picking stories in Canada. You know, legends and contemporary accounts of children who went missing while going berry picking, ones who came back but were in a trance, and ones who came back and talked about meeting fairies around berry bushes. This was a belief that got imported from Ireland. I talk about like maybe four or five cases from that essay in the book, but they're like about 20 or 25 different cases along that rubric. And that's one of those things that a lot of people who are into missing 411 say, well, what's up with the berry bushes? But I think that it's kind of right there in front of you if you just sort of look into this literature. You know, another thing is the influence of color on a lot of these, you know, in terms of people's clothing who disappear. Clothing could offend the faithful, sometimes red, sometimes green, depending on your region. And of course, you know, this removal of clothing. Well, one of the ways that you were encouraged to get away from the fairy realm was to turn your clothing inside out. So, it's, you know, not saying that everybody who has been found missing their clothing knows that. You know, maybe it's something about interaction with this other intelligence makes people want to do that, and that sort of got embedded in fairy lore in that sense. But there are a lot of the stranger things tend to line up really well with fairy lore in general worldwide, but also Celtic fairy lore.
Well, and you touching on that is just that little bitty bit is you're right. Is I don't think anybody has peeled back that onion to look at the layers of coincidence from the old fairy lore to what we're seeing now with some of these disappearances, especially with children. Do you see that, like you said, with the clothing, the colors, the things that nobody thought to look up? Now, it's getting to be common knowledge, at least in the circles that we all travel in, about the weather, the mist.
Right.
It's always been like fog. We was even growing up, I was always told, you know, like the fog is kind of like the barrier. That's almost like when it gets thin and things can happen is when the fog is out. And that's when always I think back to times of being in the outdoors and in the woods myself is always weird things always happen on the night that there was a lot of fog out. It just you had a different feeling about you, and the group you was with was a different feeling in the woods. So you tying all that together.
Nothing good ever happens in the fog.
No, it never does. Any movie you watch, they play off of that. So there's some sort of something in our DNA that kind of warns us of when you see that, like, man, there's something not right about this deal. And then you bring up, the clothing, and then the fact that it is wild that you, when the children are found, lots of times their clothes are inside out, they're on backwards. It looks like whoever put them on, like they were maybe instructed to put them on this way in order to break out of this. And it is, look, we can laugh it off. Oh, how on earth could you break away from something paranormal just because your clothes are inside out? You're like, I don't know. I didn't make up these rules. I'm just telling you what I've gathered up on. And like you talked about coming back in the trance, there's a story that you tell about a Japanese boy from 1907 that came back and wasn't the same and was never the same whenever he came back.
Yeah, this is from the work of Carmen Blacker, who is an excellent, excellent researcher. You can actually find PDFs of her work. She was an academic who studied a lot of Japanese folklore. And there was this this young boy who, in September of 1907, was actually taken. He actually disappeared. He was finally found after the entire community searched for him. He was found on someone's house who told him that this strange man had taken him from underneath this cedar tree and taken him to this delicious feast everywhere. And the child was there afterwards unable to function in the community. He was Blacker actually describes him as becoming an idiot. And you'll find this idea of people returning from the fairy realm in a trance. Obviously, you know, we talked about the missing 411, but it's very, very common. Very, very common in fairy folklore and sort of worldwide folklore, dealing with these sort of other entities from beyond the veil. Something that a lot of people might not realize is they hear the term fairy and they think, oh, well, it's just, you know, something from Ireland or Scotland or England, maybe. But there's a robust worldwide tradition. Even in places, you know, like Japan, you can find little things that are very similar to fairies. The Tengu were a set of entities who lived on top of a mountain and would often steal children and feed them debris cloaked as delicious food, which is exactly the sort of thing that I talked about in Trojan Feast, where mm-hmm. it was detritus that was, you know, made to look delicious. But you'll find fairy lore in Asia, Australia, Africa, basically any continent that has human habitation, you will find fairy lore. And when you find fairy lore, generally speaking, they will all be short. Generally speaking, they will live underground, and generally speaking, they will love to take children, which is super creepy.
Well, and just like that whole thing there, we do know, due to some of these accounts from the missing 411 books that back this up, is whenever people do return, they're almost always in a dream state. They do seem to be in some sort of shock, of course, but it's like they either, and they always say, you know, they don't want to talk about it. It's like they can't. It's like when you have a vivid dream and then you wake up and if you don't write it down or tell somebody right then, you're not going to recall it in a couple hours with any sort of real clarity. And it's almost like that's what these people are going through. Like they can't, it was too much of a sensory overload and it was almost a dream state that they were in. And that's what it makes me feel like, that's where they go. In that fairy realm, that's the way our bodies or our minds deal with it, is we're not adapt to that part. So they take us over there and it's almost like they're having fun. Like you said, feeding us sticks and moss and things like that. They're having fun at our expense. And that brings me to the next thing. Changelings. We've done a show where I dug into a bunch of changeling stuff and went deep in all these changeling things. People, it's not just in certain areas like that. The changeling thing was worldwide. Like they reported where they was, like, I think you even called them crib creepers, where people were looking at, where they talk about entities being, you know, in a baby's room, where they talk about the baby not even being the real baby. It's a log, different things like that.
Yeah, you'll find direct analogs for the changeling, not only among, you know, Jews and Arabs in the Middle East, but also among, you know, the Yoruba tribe of Nigeria and Benin. So it is something that really rears its head time again. And even more than that, the motifs of it tend to raise their head time and time again, where, you know, a child is taken and then returns changed, not necessarily being a changeling. But yeah, it's one of those real pernicious beliefs that is something that there's only been so much real changeling scholarship out there. The generally accepted sort of most widely revered work is called Der Wechselbalg, which is actually in a German word for changeling, and is out of print, and there are like 10 copies or something, and and it's only in German. Like, no one has ever actually done a translation, which if I spoke German would be a project that I would be all over. There's multiple reasons for me wanting to write this book. Part of it was, you know, I wanted to write something creepy too, and part of it was I wanted to write something about fairies, but part of it was wanting to sort of fill in this hole of this real lack of English language changeling scholarship. So to sort of give people an idea, you know, changelings were fairy babies. So if you had a child, especially if it wasn't baptized, it might be at risk for being taken by the fae folk. And what they would do is they would take the human child and replace it with one of several things. Okay. A lot of times people will say it's definitely X, Y, or Z, but no, there's several things that a changeling could be. A changeling could be a sick fairy baby that the fairies didn't want to deal with anymore. A changeling could be an elderly fairy man, because the children that were taken were most often men. Or the changeling could actually be a stock or a fetch. So it could actually be like a stump or a log in the bed. And all these were cloaked with that sort of fairy glamour that we mentioned earlier to appear as a healthy child. And only it's... only after some time did its true attributes really reveal themselves. And generally speaking, they'd be cranky. They would be insatiable. They would never stop crying. They would develop at a very, very, very slow rate. And, you know, there's a lot of scholarship out there about attempts, which I actually side with, you know, 80% of the time, attempts to explain away changelings as misunderstood congenital birth defects, especially birth defects that don't really manifest themselves until, you know, several weeks or maybe even sometimes years into a child's life. And there have been a lot of different contenders put out for that. I try to go through the most common ones in the book. There's an entire chapter dedicated to medical explanations of changelings. And I think that a lot of times that they're quite good examples, and it's actually quite a tragic aspect to all this. That's one of the reasons that, you know, a part of this book was really, really hard to write. But at the same time, there are things in some of these changeling stories that make you question whether or not that was the case in every single instance. I mean, one of the things that's that some people who are anti-medical explanation will say is that the most common means of removing a changeling was for it to exhibit its advanced age, because most commonly changelings were those elderly fairy men. And so what you do is you would somehow baffle them or amaze them, and they would say something like, "Oh, I've been on Earth 1,000 years and I've never seen something so silly." And that particular sticking point in the folklore, that particular aspect, seems to undermine the idea that we were dealing with various forms of mental disabilities, often which, you know, result in the child not being able to speak at all. I mean, obviously, so you have to sort of, it's one of those not everything or not anything sort of things that we don't do well in the paranormal community. You know, we hear someone express themselves as a skeptic of UFOs and say that, you know, most of them are unorthodox military aircraft, which is actually a view that I share, but they don't realize that, well, that might be 80 or 90% of it, but there are also smaller portions of that pie chart in there that talk about, you know, misidentification, misunderstood natural phenomena, and yes, maybe even psi phenomena, maybe even, you know, UFO structured nuts and bolts craft. And I think the changeling phenomena is something akin to that, that most of them were probably, you know, medical cases, but there are some that are really strange, I don't think quite can be accounted for in that way.
Well, and you talk, when it comes to fairies, you know, and aliens, do you think it's the same thing? Do you think that long ago it was explained away as fairies and now in modern times it's aliens for whatever reason, but really people are all seeing the same thing? And also the second part to that question is, whether it's fairies or aliens, they all seem to be wanting something from humans. You mentioned that some of them are looking for blood. Some of them are looking for human milk. Some of them are looking for DNA. I mean, it just seems like whatever they are, fairies or aliens, they're needing something from us humans. They want something from us.
Yeah, I mean, I feel... So did ancient people, or have indigenous peoples, I guess is probably a better way to put it, worldwide, encountered extraterrestrials and mistaken them for some sort of spirit fairy phenomena, or have modern people been mistaking some sort of spirit phenomena for extraterrestrials.
Right.
I want to be, again, I actually have kind of come around on the idea that perhaps the world has been visited at some point in history, perhaps even on a semi-regular basis by extraterrestrials. But in terms of the contact experience, in terms of people interacting with these beings, for me, they just share too many commonalities to say that they aren't, at the very least, strongly related. And also, at the very least, you know, strongly related to the shamanic experience. You mentioned, Cam, about how a trance was sort of these dreamlike trances were hallmarks of these states. And, dreamlike is a perfect way to describe sort of the way that you come out of the DMT experience. So I think that altered states play into this in some way as well. Returning to the question at hand, I'm kind of convinced at this point that they're the same thing. I'm not saying that one is fairies or one is aliens. I don't know what, but I think it's describing the same thing. There's some artwork from the recent republication of Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia that I just love. And if I could get the full version of it, I would probably have it framed and mounted. But the artwork has a gray alien with several masks in its hand. And it's like switching between the masks. And one is a demon and one is a fairy queen. And one is like a traditional three-eyed 1950s alien. What didn't make it actually onto that cover, what was cut out of the frame, was that the original artwork had a hand that was revealing that this gray alien itself was a puppet, and the actual puppeteer was out of frame. And I think that's probably the most elegant description for what we're seeing. So that's sort of the best representation of the way that I feel now.
Yeah. I have to agree with you, not to cut you off, but I have to agree.
Sure.
I have to agree because there's so many similarities, whether it's fae folk or alien abduction. It usually starts when the kids are little. It continues throughout their life. They talk about going to another world, whether it's a fairy world or another planet or a cave or a craft of some type. And it's almost like whatever it is, it's making kids see like a bunch of little fairies riding around on bicycles or, you know, wanting them to come out and play with them, luring them there. Adults talk about how these grays will make them believe it's something that it's not, like it's just an owl or it's something very benevolent. And then it turns out it's not. There's a lot of similarities between the two. And like I asked you previously, but before I cut you off, they all seem to want something from humans.
Right, exactly. So it's this motif that you see a lot of times in fairy faith where the idea, well, since fairy food is a sham, fairy milk is a sham as well. So that was very common, a very common motivation for substituting these children, especially in the case where they were swapping out fairy babies. It was the idea among the fairies was that by putting a fairy babe in a human crib, the fairy babe would actually receive, you know, good, decent, strong, healthy human milk. Similarly, that's why a lot of women were abducted, because it wasn't just children that were at risk from being abducted from the fairies. Typically, it was women and children. Oftentimes women would be abducted to actually go to fairyland and nurse fairy children there in fairyland. So that's obviously this need for human genetic material sometimes finds itself more explicitly into fairy belief. For example, this idea that human males were abducted for breeding purposes, to sort of beef up the bloodline of the fairies because they were a sick and dying race. Those were most commonly the things you'll see. Of course, you know, there are other outliers. Fairies often abducted human beings in general as musicians or as servants or other sort of things. But those two, especially among child abduction, are the most common motifs that repeat themselves. And I think it's pretty easy to see that with a little imagination becomes this reworked hybrid children narrative in ufology. And I'm not the first one to point this out at any case. But it really is sort of a one-to-one mapping on of this idea. I mean, in both cases, the race is dying and needs some sort of genetic material from human beings to give their race a punch in the arm and help them survive. That's explicitly mentioned in countless alien abduction stories.
Mm, yeah, man. Excellent book. I suggest everybody go out there to get it. Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions by Joshua Cutchin. Joshua, tell people where they can get it. I saw recently where you're selling out everywhere. Well, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing as long as people don't overpay for it, because if you overpay for it, A, I don't want you to, and B, I'm not seeing any of that extra money, so don't overpay for it. If you're not paying around $23 for it, then you are overpaying for it. And the reason I bring this up is because there have been sometimes in the past couple of weeks, when you search this on Amazon, you'll wind up with third party sellers who are marking it up at exorbitant rates. So don't do that. The safest, easiest thing to do is to just visit joshuacutchin.com. I have a couple of different links on there that will take you to, for example, the Amazon page that has several different listings. All the vendors, just choose the cheapest one, or Barnes and Noble, where there hasn't been an issue at all with supply or anything. But it seems to be difficult to keep in stock at Amazon, which is exciting. That's a great thing. Kindle edition should be out in the next couple of weeks, so I will make sure that I post on that both on my website and on my Twitter and my Facebook page and my Facebook author page, which I just set up a couple of weeks ago. So you'll be able to find out about it all across there. So if you just look for me, you'll find out about the Kindle edition, which should be out soon.
When are we going to get you to do an Audible book where you read all your books for Audible?
I have had so many people bug me about that. So if you want to see that happen, because I'm totally down for it.
We're pushing it now. It's going down.
All right, we'll push it. I encourage everyone to write their congressman. No, visit Anomalous Books, which you can find at anomalousbooks.com. It's my publisher. Click the contact link. There's an email inquiry there. And bug them about it, because I could do it myself, but it has to be up to the publisher's specifications and, you know, with recording equipment and whatnot. I would love to do it. And Anomalist has not done an audiobook, so maybe it's a good place to start. So bug them. Bug people.
For sure. Now, hey, are you doing anything else? You got anything else before we let you go that you got, like, coming down the chute? What do you got working on?
Well, I'm sort of in an advisory capacity for some projects with a couple people. There might be some collaborative stuff in the future. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. As much as I can do that, I usually end up starting a new project within 2 or 3 months.
Someone gets bored fast.
Yeah. Idle hands, right? I think I owe it to myself to take a little bit of a longer break from paranormal writing and actually put to paper an idea for a fiction book that I have. We'll see if it's good or if it's garbage. It's going to be about something I don't think anybody's going to expect it about. It's not going to be like, you know, the one man's journey to find his inner child or something. It's not going to be like a Lifetime movie or anything, but it's going to be a horror novel, but we'll see how that goes.
If there's no tuba in that book, I don't want to read it. If there's nothing about a tuba in there, don't even publish it.
That's a goal. I will slip a tuba in there. So
yes, that's what I'm talking about. Joshua, thank you so much for writing this book, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to sit down and chat with us.
Thank you for having me on, guys. I'll be honest, I've had a long day. I've been teaching high school band camp all day, so I was like, oh, I love those guys, but I'm gonna be so tired. But now I don't even want the conversation to end. I'm stoked now. So the fact that you guys can do that to me says a lot about you,
Phil. Awesome.
All right, man. Thanks. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we did doing it. Joshua Cutchin, he's a great guy. If you want to hear the rest of our interview with him, you're going to have to go over to the Elite Show. And on Elite, we're going to finish up that interview. But fascinating stuff. I mean, I like his writing style. I like how he digs in. I mean, like with the Trojan Feast, I never really even thought about the connections in the paranormal world with food and drink offerings. You know, you're talking about drinking fairy milk and eating, you know, bread and stuff offered to you by fairies and how aliens sometimes will offer things to drink. And then, you know, with these other book, The Brimstone Deceit, I never even thought about supernatural scents or how odors often tie in with paranormal sightings. You know, we talk about it from time to time. When people see a UFO, they smell ozone, mm-hmm. things like that, or you'll smell the perfume of a of a dead grandfather, and it reminds you of them, and you're like, is that a spirit? I didn't see anything, but I could definitely smell it. And that was his favorite cologne. He liked Brut 33. I know exactly what it is.
Who don't?
I mean, you know what I'm saying? And this new book, I mean, this one's much darker than his first two.
Yeah, way darker.
Because, you know, there is a crazy amount of children that are abducted. And this is stretches across, like we've talked about before, with the boogeyman. Every culture seems to have these stories of something is going to come get your child. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if you better get them baptized, or you better get them something. You got to go through these steps, or these changelings will come and take your baby. And the connection between how very similar the stories are when considering fae folk and then extraterrestrials, it's a very interesting thought process, because it's very similar. And you know, one has to think of, is it the same phenomenon going on? It's just all those stories from long ago, they were blaming fairies for them. And now in modern day times, the same things are happening, but now we're blaming it on extraterrestrials. Or are both things happening simultaneously? I don't know, man, but it's a scary book.
Well,
what do you think about it?
What I think I like the most about his books is that if anybody is new to this genre or new to reading and getting into these kind of subjects, and you've just kind of been introduced, you've been dabbling in it, and you found the show, and you've just found, I would suggest getting all three of his books now and reading those first before you got into any of the other books, because they're going to give you, as much as we, and I say we as meaning a human being, as much as we like to put things in proper boxes in order for us to understand instead of just leaving it open and just being like, eh, if you like that OCD ideas of I need to find out links, I need to find out how it fits together, read those books first before you go into anything else.
Yeah.
It's kind of like we said, when you start getting into ancient history, it's best, in my opinion, to read Graham Hancock's work before you start getting into everything else. So it kind of opens up your eyes to, okay, now there's that, now I can branch out. But with his books, it's those lines, those threads that tie things together. And especially if you love stories about missing people and yeah, you like all the way it works together. And like he points out, whether you're in the Bigfoot camp or you're in the fairy camp or UFO abduction camp
or serial killer.
Yes. It all, that book really lays it all out to where it almost fits anything. You know, it's kind of like those drawings that makes it look like the person's pointing a gun or something at you in the drawing, anywhere you walk in the room.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
That's the way that book is. It's like whatever side you're on, that book can fit into your wheelhouse. You can look, and then it will help you understand more things. It's just something, I really enjoy his writing. I can't wait.
I do too, man.
I can't wait for him to write more books.
And, you know, it's what's scary is the similarities. You know, when you think about it, many cultures have been talking about, you know, like even as recent as David Pilatus' work with Missing 411, mm-hmm, how these people go missing when they're picking berries. Now, yes, why is it when they're picking berries? But if you go with Joshua's research, and he shows that many tales from long ago, from a certain part of the world, they warned about picking berries, and that's where you would see fae folk and stuff. And it starts making you think, holy cow, man, there really is a link.
I think in today's society, I think we're all guilty of this. It's like we talk about is, we believe that because it happened 200 or 300 years ago or 100 years ago, that we think they are foolish and that we are so much more intelligent than they are, and that they were easily fooled by certain things, and we're not fooled by that, so it can't be real. There's no such thing as fae, and there's no such thing as, you know, the fae abducting people or Bigfoot abducting people, because other people were just being fooled. But like you said, when you find out that this folklore has been around and there's basis for it, well, that's what makes it even the most disturbing.
Yeah.
Is we're like, well, how long have we known about these things?
Yeah, well, the book is made by Anomalist Books. I'll put links to it in the show notes, or you can just go over to Anomalist Books or anywhere else. I'm sure you can find the book. It's an excellent pickup. I suggest you do that. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
You know, I've got so much stuff going on. I really don't know. Our brud opened up his gym. He's got all the mats in. We got all that going now. So I don't really know what I'm going to do this week. It's kind of up in the air. I'm busy, but it's not one of those things like I have an itinerary that I have to follow this week. I'm kind of to the breeze. And other than that, I'm just waiting to hear about the baseball tournament this weekend.
Yeah, I got another baseball tournament in the heat. So we'll be doing that. But outside of that, I'm like you. I just got a basic, pretty plain Jane week, you know, nothing serious. If you have a story of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. And you can follow the show on all forms of social media. If you really want to help us out, you can write us a review on iTunes. Go over there. Be sure you click the stars, the 5 stars when you write the review, because some people have written some and forgot to give it a rating. You got to rate it and write the review, but we'd really appreciate that. The numbers over there are really growing. I hope everybody has a really good week. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.